We're going to open up the phone lines now, give you an opportunity to chat with Robert Young Pelton. I don't know how long his phone line will last, so let's do this hour. Then I'll have more Full Moon Open Lines next hour on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, I have to assume we're using some of these mercenaries, the war against drugs. We're probably sending them to Colombia. They're all over the place, huh?
Yeah, and a mercenary would be someone who fights an active war. And in Colombia, you find that there's a whole mix of militias, hitmen, contractors. I mean, you name it. They're all messing around there making money. In Iraq, you find the same mix where you've got everybody from Kurds who work as hitmen to cops that work at death squads. I mean, it's a real mix.
Are these nice guys or, are they really tough?
The typical American contractor is a guy who's been in the military for, 5 to 10 years, really can't get much money when he gets out because of his skill level, but can go back into the private sector and carry a gun and make a lot more money, which is about, $400 or $500 a day. Are they nice guys? Yeah, overwhelmingly, they're just normal people, but they're in a hellacious situation, and that tends to change people.
How old are they? What are they?
I'd say average age is a little older than most people realize. It's anywhere from about maybe 25 to 40 and 50. I mean, they range.
Oh, okay.
Quite a bit. Yeah.
Families or single?
Most have families. The interesting thing about going to all these training programs and hanging out with these guys is that they all start off because there's usually a financial incentive. A lot of guys get out of the military, and all of a sudden when they have to work and pay for things, they realize that, oh my God, I don't make enough money. And a lot of guys get themselves into trouble. So this is, to most guys, a quick fix, like pay off a mortgage, buy a boat, pay down your debts or whatever. And then it becomes a lifestyle, and of course, families and children suffer. Not as much as the troops, of course, because they're over there for a year making a lot less money, but it's a high-stress job, and that does change people.
Let's go to the phones. Wildcard line, you're on the air with us. Hello there.
Hello, George. This is Bill. I'm calling you from the Ohio Turnpike.
Hey, Bill. Welcome. Thanks.
Welcome. Hey, got a question for your guest there. Actually, first of all, I want to compliment him as having one of the most logical explanations of what's going on in the world right now. And my question is, with the definition he's given, how do we get out of it? And I'll take my answer off the air, and thank you, sir.
Okay, and I assume he means Iraq and all these other places.
It's like sticking your head into a hornet's nest. I think what we have to do is we have to start with a blank piece of paper. I think what we're doing now is being perpetuated by an administration with a political agenda. Hopefully, when we come around to elections, unfortunately, people will die before then. It's time to listen to the American people and to look at what's really happening in this country. Right now, we're caught in a crossfire. It doesn't really matter whether we're there or not. And you've got this sort of seething group of people in Iraq that want to sort of claim power or ownership over their country, and we're just in their way. So my experience, I've been there many times, is it just is getting progressively worse.
Would you pull out the troops immediately if you would?
Yeah, I mean, we're building permanent bases there. I mean, one of the things that people don't want to talk about is that we have shifted our focus from Europe to the Middle East.
Right. We have no plans to leave there, contrary to what we hear.
Right, but we can stay inside those bases. They're huge bases, and they get mortared once in a while, but that's not really that big a threat. We keep talking about how the Iraqis are going to stand up and we stand down. That's a joke. The Iraqis are basically being trained to fight a civil war. We're arming them and training them for that. Things are going to go downhill very quickly once we pull troops out, but at some point, the people of Iraq have to determine their own future. That's what freedom's all about. And we had the same mess when we started. We launched into a full-scale civil war long after our Revolutionary War, and we came out of it fine.
Robert, the world's second largest known oil reserves in Iraq. We are not leaving.
But keep in mind, there's something more than politics here. It's called business. And ultimately, business determines what politics do. You need a lot of money to run for office. And you'll find that business goes on whether wars are being fought or not. And whether we run Iraq or whether the Iraqis run Iraq or whether the Iranians run Iraq, people will always be making money off that oil.
So true. Now, what's going on there with the oil fields in the north and south? Are they guarded quite heavily?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest problem is that they don't have a lot of modern equipment, and their pipelines are very, very sensitive. So if you blow up a pipeline, you basically stop a major amount of oil from flowing out of the country. So they have that problem. The other thing is that, you know, there's what they call efficiencies in the actual fields. Are you getting as much oil out of the ground as you should? There's all kinds of technology and ways to do that. But it's such a dangerous environment that you can't just go over there and go about your business and fly home. I mean, it's quite difficult to do very simple things over there. But yes, at some point, I'm hoping that Iraq will be a very wealthy country and its people will share in that wealth.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Is this me?
Yes, sir. Hi.
Oh, hi. This is Najib Malik here. Anyway, I'm an African that lived here since the 60s. My father was the ambassador under President Johnson all the way through President Carter.
Really? Okay. Thank you.
Oh, sure thing. I just want to compliment Robert on his knowledge, on his neutral position. He's just so impressive. I have two questions, George, and then I'll hang up.
Sure.
Is it true that in Afghanistan the Americans have dug a 10-mile long tunnel underneath the Kabul airport? Is one. And the other question is, during my father's time, there was no such thing as warlords or drug dealers in Afghanistan. Period. And are the Americans thinking of staying longer in Afghanistan? And if so, what's their purpose? Is it to help us only, or is it an access to the Indian Ocean? I'm just curious to know if they're going to be there on long terms, which I wish they would. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome, Najib.
Well, smart questions for a guy who probably knows the answers. But number one, I just based on us trying to pave the road between Kabul and Kandahar, I don't think we could build a tunnel of any size or shape simply because it's a huge engineering process. They had this myth in Iraq for some strange reason. They used to think that there was a secret tunnel that went between the Green Zone and the airport in Iraq. So no such thing exists. Secondly, we've handed over peacekeeping duties to what we call the international community, which is, of course, NATO, ISAF. But we haven't really weighed in with the reconstruction money or the massive amount of funds required to bring Afghanistan up to even sort of third world levels. We do spend money there, and we do try to make things better. But we don't have much of a strategic interest in Afghanistan other as a sort of a, if you look at a checkerboard, if you figure we sort of hop from Iraq to Afghanistan, it gives us a nice strategic central point in what could be a very volatile area, which is essentially Pakistan and India. So we will be there, not in the same sense that we will be in Iraq, because there's nothing really benefiting us in Afghanistan other than a land base or an air base.
Are there other countries involved or other companies involved in this kind of security in other countries?
Yeah, the paradigm that you see in Iraq and Afghanistan has been around for a very long time in places like Colombia or even the Congo and, I mean, South Africa. Most people assume, for example, in your hometown, if you get into trouble, you'll call the police. But rich folks don't do that. They have their own private security companies, you know, like Pinkertons or whatever. It's much the same way in the third world, where you don't rely on the local police. They might even rob you, so you have privatized security. Even dictators hire their own private security. It's not that unusual to ramp that up and say, well, gee, if I want to fight a war, I'd be better off hiring professional soldiers from other countries than using my ragtag army. In America, obviously, we have one of the world's finest armies, so we find it kind of humorous that we have to hire Colombians and Salvadorans and people to provide security in a place like Iraq. If you want to go into any American compound in the Green Zone, you have to speak Spanish. It's almost hilarious that you have to speak Nepalese to a guy to get into the chow hall.
Next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello there.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
My name's Kelly. I'm calling from the Bay Area.
Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I have a question for Robert.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm ex-military. I'm a U.S. Marine, and I've been a cop for a couple years on the SWAT team. I've been thinking about being a private contractor, going into that type of business. What kind of advice, what are your takes on doing that for a couple years to make a quick buck, get out, and buy a house, start a family?
Okay, well, thanks, Clay. I'll break it down to two parts. Number one, if you go to blackwaterusa.com, you'll find out that they have an 8-week course, which costs about $20,000, but if you pass, they'll finance it with your, you know, pay. If you fail, it'll charge you nothing. There's other courses you can take, but the bottom line is that you have the skills. If you're SWAT and ex-Marine, you're pretty much the kind of guy they're looking for. Secondly, I got to warn you, when you go to Iraq, none of those skills come into play. I mean, yes, you can be trained as a great PSD operator, but the biggest weapon or enemy you're going to face is what they call the EFP or IED, which is a highly explosive, you know, sort of jerry-rigged device that'll blow the hell out of you. The new EFPs go right through armor, and they're planted within sort of an hour of the troops going by a road. So when I was there, the biggest casualties were just simply driving down the road and getting blown up. And unfortunately, that wreaks havoc on someone who's used to sort of fighting a war or using a gun or using skills. So it's a tough, stressful job.
It's a different kind of war out there now, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not even really a war because you're not fighting anybody. You're just getting blown up. And if you do have contact, as a security operator, you can't just sit there and hammer away for 5 or 6 hours. I mean, you have to get off the X, as they call it. You have to get your client away from there. So you never really get to engage where you get the satisfaction of winning anything. You're just surviving day to day to day.
Why didn't, Germany, for example, or Japan, why did they fight this way when they knew they were going to lose? Why didn't they take their uniforms off and simply do what's going on in Iraq?
Well, both those countries had been completely pulverized, both financially and sort of morally. And secondly, they surrendered. I mean, there's a big emotional difference between a country surrendering after launching a hostile action.
So they were done.
Right, or just being invaded. I mean, we just invaded Iraq. I mean, we gave them some warning, but we essentially went in there. And you have to understand, from the Iraqis' point of view, they didn't declare war on us. They didn't have any WMDs. And they weren't really a bellicose nation, and they sure as heck weren't an Islamic fundamentalist nation. So you already started off with that sort of ill will. Even with that said, they still looked forward to some kind of improvement once we had taken over that country. And we had essentially colonialized, but we had a viceroy named Paul Bremer who was running the country and doing everything he could to make it easy for people to invest there and get things going, but it just went to hell.
Were they ever looking for weapons of mass destruction, even the private security companies?
They had a group run by the CIA that never really left the green zone. I mean, they tried. I even worked for CBS 60 Minutes because I heard that there were a number of chemical-tipped rockets hidden in an archaeological site. But literally, the UN had done such a good job cleaning that place out. And don't forget, they were in there for 10 years. And when I talked to some of the people when they went through the inspections, they were rigorous. They weren't goofing around. And so the bottom line is that there were no weapons of mass destruction because the UN had made sure there were none. And there was no, I mean, you would have think that the Bush administration would have said, oh, look at that. You know, here's one weapon. But there wasn't even one weapon. There was some blood. There were some blood thinners found in RPGs. I had a lead on a group of chemical weapons that were essentially OGM or anti-tank rockets that had some kind of chemicals in them. Yes, they had mustard gas shells, but they go back to World War, I. There's nothing unusual about that. And that's about it.
I had a guest on a couple weeks ago, Robert, who said that he believes the Russians helped get the WMDs out of the country, hid them in Syria, and the reason why we haven't said anything about it in terms of government is because we don't want to step on Russia's toes. I don't believe that, sir.
I don't believe that's crap. I was along the border during the war, and they were bombing the hell out of anything that moved. They did get some money out, and Saddam got some of his family members out, and a lot of the guys on those deck of cards tried to get out to Syria but were turned back. But the bottom line is that Saddam never really had weapons of mass destruction. He was eager to create them.
He wanted them, right?
Right, exactly. And that goes for most nickel and dime countries. But he had used chemical weapons on his own people. But we're talking about the 80s, and we're talking about very traditional type of chemical bombs and weapons. The whole stink was about using Scud missiles, which are like basically oversized firecrackers that had a range of about 400 miles, if that. So even if he had weapons of mass destruction, it was all about whether he could fire them into Israel. And you remember that was the big thing in the first war.
Yeah.
And that was it. So there was never any threat to America. Now, yes, Saddam did not like America, and yes, Saddam would be willing to hear anybody's story about, well, can you do this to embarrass America? But ultimately, he had his own problems. You know, he had a war with Iran, he had poverty in his own country, he had uprisings in the North and the South, and he was boxed in for 10 years, and he was basically an ineffective tin-pot dictator.
You think he was tricked on the Kuwait incursion?
When he invaded Kuwait, you have to study your history books. First of all, that's probably one of the richest parts of what used to be Iraq. Now, Iraq never was a country. I mean, this is a myth that's being perpetrated. Iraq is actually three types of people, or what the Ottomans called, you know, sort of governates.
Were they potentates? Is that what they called them?
There's a name for them which escapes me right now. But the Ottomans went in there, and then they figured this out very quickly, and they created three different areas. And that's basically the north with the Kurds, the middle with the Sunnis, and the south with the Shia. And then the British went in there. And once again, because of the oil and because they had to have something to rule, which they also did in Saudi Arabia, they took a bunch of desert and said, hey, you guy on the camel, you run this place, you're our friend, give us the oil. So they had to create a legitimacy or a state that they could then plunder. And the bottom line is that Iraq has never been a cohesive country except under Saddam Hussein.
And there was a time he was our friend.
Oh, yes, he was. As a matter of fact, when I was in Pakistan, they had all these M4 rifles made by General Motors. And I said, where'd these come from? Well, these are what they gave to Iraq to fight Iran, because we hated Iran more than we hated Iraq. And, you know, there's that famous picture of Donald Rumsfeld
shaking his hand,
sucking up to Saddam.
Yeah, that's true. And remember the old saying, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah, but they're all our enemies now, so we don't have any friends left.
No, you are absolutely right with that. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Good evening, George.
Hi.
This is Mike calling from Elberton, Georgia.
Sure, Mike.
Usually, as usual, we learn more from your guests than 5 years of spin from the White House, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
A couple of questions for you. We always hear this about the terror cells here in the United States. Couldn't these people learn from our mercenary tactics and create more hell and havoc over here with small little groups that we could never detect than actually worrying about massive cells in this country? And also, I'd like to get his take on why we have not used mercenaries, or mercenaries have not worked with Castro, and why he's been allowed to be the person right off our coast this entire time.
Now, he's just raising embarrassing questions for the government. Number one, what I find interesting is one of the last shows I wanted to do was to show how you would attack America, how you would drive a semi-truck across the border between Mexico and America, how you could hijack propane trucks, fuel trucks that come to gas stations, how you could FedEx people bombs, how you could rent a commercial aircraft flying into buildings, so on and so forth, to show that you can never make a democratic country perfectly safe. Now, if you understand that, then you say, well, why haven't they attacked this? Well, they don't exist. They is not that big a fear. Yes, there are people, both sort of right-wing militia types and Islamic fundamentalists and who knows, that want to do damage to the state, as we call it. But they're very ineffective. I mean, for two reasons. One is that you're not going to overthrow this government because it is democratic. And secondly, there aren't that many people that are willing to die for, you know, a cause like that. I personally think that terrorism is a part of everyday life in most of the world except America. I mean, we just came, you know, into the modern times when we had the 9/11. In terms of using mercenaries against Fidel Castro, I mean, we tried that, and that's actually one of the things that triggered the Church Pike report, is that you can't do that. You can't be, you know, sending poison cigars to world leaders and hiring mercenaries in the Bay of Pigs and so on, because it never works. And I don't know why we have a hands-off policy with Cuba, but in some time in the near future, they're going to be our best friend.
Yeah, you're right about that, Robert. Sooner than later. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls for our special guest tonight, Robert Young Pelton on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll be back. We'll continue to take our phone calls with our guest, Robert Young Pelton, next hour. Full Moon Open Lines, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, can we assume that hired security possibly got involved in JFK's assassination back in 63?
Huh. You know, it's interesting. I'm not a conspiracy buffer. I'm up on things. But, you know, if you look at a lot of interesting, intriguing things, whether it's, you know, the Watergate break-in or, you know, who's involved in skullduggery, it's always contractors that used to work for the CIA.
Exactly.
And I can't explain why, but these are people who specialize in intrigue, and those people are anonymous and they're sort of deniable, and this is what I find over and over again when I go into this new privatized world of security, where you're dealing with a corporation who's doing business for the government, and there's sort of a firewall between, you know, the corporation and the public. You know, the government, if a soldier does something, I mean, there's laws and there's rules and court martials, whatever. If the government does something, you get to your FOIAs and you can do a lot of investigative stuff. But when it comes to corporations, it's a closed door.
Okay, let's go back to the calls. We'll pick it up by going to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Yeah, this is Nick of San Antonio, WOAI.
Hey, Nick.
I echo a previous caller. This saves on 5 hours of listening to Spin Doctors. It's been a wonderful guest. I'll make this brief and listen to off the air because
okay.
I know you have a lot of people want to get in. I feel like a runaway freight train is coming down on me. I'm stalled in my car, can't get my door open. I'm talking about Darfur, Sudan, and the strange thing about Arabs versus black Muslims. How does that fit in the world scene? Can the worst-case scenario be averted by October the 1st if enough people band together? And what's his take on it? Is it a repeat of the hoodoos in 1994, or is it just me? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you very much.
Well, I think your caller's probably got media fatigue. One of the interesting things about Darfur is that you remember there's been a civil war going on in Sudan, and most people typify it as being sort of Arabs in the north and black animists in the south. It's actually a little bit more mercenary than that. There's actually oil in Sudan, and obviously Sudan is one of those British concoctions in which they grabbed a whole bunch of territory and made it into a country. I spent some time with the rebels in Sudan, and what I found was fascinating is that it's a country that's just sort of been glued together. Now, Darfur is the latest way for this large, it's the largest country in Africa, to glue itself together, even though it should be in smaller pieces. We became aware of Darfur because of Colin Powell, and of course he went there and said there's genocide going on, and he used the G word, which means the United Nations is supposed to get involved. They did it in a very tepid way. What's interesting is that private military corporations actually fielded proposals to say, hey, we can go in there and provide logistical support, in other words, air support and basic things like toilets and cooking and whatever. And we can also go in there and create a security force that'll keep these warring sides apart. And if need be, we will wipe out the Janjaweed if that's what it takes. So there are proposals on the table that have all been turned down because we're still sort of respecting the sovereignty of the Sudanese government.
Next up, our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us with Robert Young Pelton. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
I wanted to thank Mr. Pelton for putting his life on the line to get the truth out. Also, I wanted to congratulate him on his Golden Candle Award from the Open Source Intelligence Network. And the question is, short of going to these places, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Colombia, what's the best way to develop an accurate picture of what's going on out there?
Oh, that's a good question because I get this a lot because they say, well, I'm not going to go to Iraq just to find out that it's a mess. I tend to use news aggregators, whether it be Google or Yahoo, and I tend to read localized papers or news sources. And obviously they're biased towards one side or the other, but at least you're getting another stream. During the war in Iraq, for example, I watched two televisions. I watched ITN and I watched Al Jazeera, and I saw two different wars unfolding in front of my eyes. But hopefully the combination between that and actually being in it made me realize what was going on there. If anybody's interested in any topic at all, I would advise them to use what they call RSS, or real simple, I forget the last, that's what it means, but basically you just type in the word you're interested in Google, let's say, and it'll send you stories about that item. Secondly, with things like Skype, which is completely free, where you can get on your computer and talk to people around the world, or email, which is also completely free, you can communicate directly with groups that are interested in that region. And there's all kinds of specialty groups on the internet that are, whether it's Darfur or Congo or you name it.
How do you deal with the language barrier?
Well, when I go to places, I do two things. One is I learn the basic bits and pieces of the language, hello, thank you, whatever. But I also hire a local guide, more because people, I can understand the language, but I don't know what they mean. And a local guide can tell you, oh, that guy, you know, don't listen to him, he's full of it. Or this guy, he's the elder, talk to him first, whatever. So I never consider myself an expert. Even if I do speak the language or the rudimentary bits of the language, I always use a local guide.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. Your turn. Hi there.
Hello. You've kind of covered what I want to ask about a little bit, but let me put my question this way, please.
Sure.
It seems to me that in going into Iraq, we disturbed the balance of power that was highly favorable to us in the sense that two of our enemies were bleeding each other. What we did was take the place of one of them. We did it in the name of moral requirement to depose a ruthless dictator and weapons of mass destruction. I'd like to ask your guest if he thinks those were the real reasons.
From what I know, and I have not worked in the White House and I've never talked to George Bush about his rationale, there has always been a long-standing effort by what they call the neocons, the Rumsfelds, the Cheneys, to create a reason for American military intervention, because we are only a power as long as we keep rolling forward. Part of what we do is say, well, we don't want to be isolationists. We need to continually project in our power, because if we don't fill that vacuum, somebody else will. And you mentioned oil, and you mentioned there's also strategic balance there. So when we have this sort of conspiracy theory, like, did we go there just for the oil? Did we go there, you know, because there were really WMDs we didn't find? No, it's like playing checkers. We're just moving one country forward. And the further we project, makes it harder for other countries to project their force into that region.
With little bennies along the way.
Exactly. Now, the problem is, and anybody who reads history understands this, is an empire gets too far. And in my book, License to Kill, I talk about the edge of the empire. Afghanistan is the edge of our empire. That's where it stops. We can go no further. And Pakistan and India are the great sort of wastelands in China, of course, that we don't dare enter or mess with.
Would we even consider that, Robert?
Well, China is doing bad things to us on a daily basis.
But we're letting them.
Well, you know, do you remember back when China was our enemy? And remember one of our planes was forced down and
yep.
There was a big confrontation and we rattled our saber and everybody said, oh, my God, that's right, China. China is our enemy. You know, we conquered Russia, but we never focused on China. Well, economically, they're killing us.
I remember the days when we had ping pong diplomacy, because I interviewed a guy, Graham Steenhoven was his name. I guarantee I never forget, not on that. And he was one of the ping pong players who went to China, kind of opened up the door, and then Richard Nixon did his thing. And all of a sudden, we became so-called friends with China, even though we really aren't.
But the interesting thing about China is we chose not to be bellicose at a certain point, and we decided to say, well, better the devil you know than the devil you don't. With Iran, we've become xenophobic. We just won't even deal with Iran. I mean, we currently already have special operation teams inside Iran training insurgents to help assist overthrow the government. I mean, we're trying to damage Iran as much as we can, and what they call the frog in the pot, where we keep turning up the heat and hopefully the frog will jump out of the pot.
A slow simmer, huh?
Right, and we've been doing that ever since shortly after we were in Iraq. And if you look at Afghanistan and Iraq, we have Iran in a vice, so we think. But you've noticed recently that Iran has been able to escape. I mean, most of our confrontational issues.
Yes.
They've weaseled out of. And a great lesson was Israel's incursion into Lebanon. You can't be an elephant and try to stomp on an ant. I mean, you'll tear down the tent. And what we're finding is that when we go into these what look like small countries with sort of third world armies, we create such havoc that we actually end up bleeding ourselves and destroying what we stand for.
Absolutely. What do you think of the Israeli Mossad? Are they as good as everybody thinks?
No, but... they want you to believe that. It's like the man that's pulling the levers. The Mossad was allowed. I mean, I think Spielberg did a great film called Munich, in which he showed that the Mossad is not some group of supermen. It's just basically dedicated people who will break their moral code.
Sure.
And that is, and obviously they're well trained people, but so are our people, and so is every other intelligence nation, a group in the world. But it's the mystique, the fact that they can reach out and kill you after years and years when you're not looking. I mean, that's what they like to project.
Let's move on with some more calls before the hour is gone. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing? My name's Tom. Robert, I'm a big fan of your writing. We actually have a friend in common, I believe. The name Tank rings a bell.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to, along the lines of what you were just saying, I'm a prior military police. I did contracting with Tank, some other guys. And along the lines of what you're saying about being the elephant and tearing the tent down, being around contracting, being prior military, and you being around contractors and the military, do you feel, as I do, that the contracting concept is a lot more or is a more viable way of prosecuting the global war on terror? My personal opinion, being exposed to the military again after being out for 15-plus years, is that it's, in my humble opinion, it's kind of like a social experiment run amok where they've taken the warrior ethos and replaced them with the Tabitha Soren MTV generation way of doing things. And I think it's created an ineffective fighting force, you know, in general terms.
Right. Well, let's look at the enemy. The enemy is a privatized, non-state enemy. So when you try to put a traditional military, which practices marching, turning left, turning right, you know, needs massive support infrastructure against this sort of light, modular, almost internet type of enemy, it's not going to win. I mean, days after September 11th, Tommy Franks was asked what he wanted to do, and he was going to run tanks up the Khyber Pass just like it was 1912. Thankfully, George Tenet said, no, we're going to put in small groups of CIA officers and special forces, and we're going to fight this dirty, just like we did in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia. We actually won the war in Afghanistan in about 3 weeks. It's the peace we lost. And Tommy Franks got his wish when we went into Iraq with an old-fashioned, you know, steamroller kind of military offensive. Once again, we lost the peace. So modern warfare is not who has the most guns and the most missiles. It's who can be the most diplomatic and the lightest and the least destructive, and also probably the most supportive of, because the people we hate today are the guys we're rebuilding their homes and we want them to be our friends, and we keep forgetting that.
What happened to the Iraqi soldiers? They just left.
Well, you know, here's the funny thing. When I was there during the war, you'd drive up to a battlefield and you'd see these smoking vehicles, and you'd say, where the hell are the bodies? There's no dead bodies in these vehicles. Well, the Iraqis aren't dumb. They fought this war 10 years earlier. They all slept away from the vehicles, and the first time we lit one up, which was usually at night, they just took all their clothes off and their helmets and ran like hell.
Yeah.
So I bumped into all the soldiers living sort of in abandoned buildings, and they all went home, basically.
Are they, in some cases, law-abiding people now?
Well, of course. I mean, don't forget they were conscripts. I mean, the Iraqi army was primarily just like the conscript army we have. It's just basically people from your rural areas, inner cities, whatever. They're not big Saddam supporters.
No, they're just following orders.
Yeah, they're just cannon fodder, and they ran, baby. They knew exactly what was about to unfold when that first missile hit.
So who are the insurgents there now, Robert?
Well, the insurgents are small groups of various factions, and they could be criminal, they could be religious, they could be just some guy, some sheikh in this town doesn't like the sheikh in that town.
Are they Syrians and Iranians?
No, that's one of the myths. I mean, I was in Syria on the border when the Syrians were streaming across and they were getting gunned down by the hundreds, but that's always over. That's not what's happening in Iraq. In Iraq, you have a power vacuum. And in lieu of any power structure, people battle for power. They're not fighting against America. They're fighting against each other.
It is a civil war, isn't it?
Well, a civil war is a very cleanly defined conflict between two major sides. I mean, I could rattle off at least 20 Mujahideen groups who are not fighting us. They're fighting each other.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello. Jonathan from Seattle.
Hello, Jonathan.
KBI.
Sure thing.
Hey, great show. I'm wondering about the Saudi Arabia and Pakistan connection, who are supposedly our allies. And then you talked about bin Laden wasn't. There were some guys from our military who tried to take out bin Laden. They were stood down. Does this make al-Qaeda a CIA front group? Or that's one thing Alex Jones and Mike Rupert have talked about. Do you agree with that, that they're a CIA asset? Or
no, the al-Qaeda, just so you know, al-Qaeda is one of many names that bin Laden has given to his little sort of homeboys. I call them homeboys because there's about 120 of them. It's not that large of an organization. Yes, they do have connections through all the jihadis who went through there in the 80s, and yes, they have connections with other Islamic groups around the world, but it is not a major force in this world. The connection between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, well, if you watch the movie Syriana, you notice something beginning that most people from places like Pakistan have to work overseas. Saudi Arabia is full of expats that go there and work. When I was on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, almost every single person had a relative, a son, whatever, that worked in Saudi Arabia. Some of them were married to Saudi wives. Jalaluddin Haqqani, who was a famous warlord that we supported against the Russians in the 80s, is now fighting us on the border in Miramshah. It's the same players, it's the same tune, it's the same dance. We just happen to be on the wrong side this time.
What role did the American government have in the 9/11 attacks, though?
None as far as I know. I mean, the only time the government got involved was either on the local level, which is the firemen trying to save people, or this Air Force that was scrambled to potentially shoot down the planes. And of course,
but what about the war games on 9/11?
Well, I call things as I see them, and I was in my bathrobe watching planes fly into buildings, and that's what I saw, and that's what I knew happened.
Crossing the Rubicon by Michael Rupert.
Right, but I mean...
Who has left the country now, by the way. You know that? Michael's gone.
I just heard that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I can't speak to any theories. All I know is what I know.
Time for one more call, and then that is it. Your phone's holding up for us. Wildcard line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello?
Hello.
Yeah,
hi.
Go ahead, sir.
Just one comment. All political opinions and such aside, my experiences in Iraq, I'm a recently returned soldier, are a bit different.
By the way, thank you for your service.
Thank you. We did see some weapons of mass destruction. There were documented cases of soldiers hit with roadside bombs that contained sarin gas. There were missions where all the components to create sarin gas were found in a known insurgent area. And furthermore, with the comment about it being local Iraqis and somewhat of a civil war, the people we were fighting, we saw Algerians, Syrians, Chechens, Bulgarians. There were people from all over the world, and we were fighting radical Islamists and not a civil war when I was there. So all opinions aside, that's my true experience.
Okay, thanks. Any quick reaction to that, Robert?
Yeah, I've heard this story over and over again. In Afghanistan, we're fighting foreigners, but the bottom line is that the people that are trying to kill Americans and each other over there are predominantly Iraqis. Yes, there's a small contingent, a very small contingent of foreigners, but it is a war amongst Iraqis to gain control over that country. And yes, we've done our best, but we no longer can push that country towards peace. It's falling into chaos.
Where do you get the book, License to Kill?
Any bookstore that has a sign on top has my book in it.
There you are.
You can also go to my website, comebackalive.com, if you want to learn more about it.
Great. Robert, thanks for being on the program. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
And we will be back in just a moment. Full moon time, so we've got open lines. We might as well take advantage of that. Robert's phone held up for us to get a good, solid couple hours. I'll be back in a moment with you on Coast to Coast AM.